You're back on Coast to Coast AM, and we're talking about the idea of ancient civilizations being contacted by non-human intelligences. And if you're going down that road, you can see the evidence of this everywhere. Oh, every corner of the globe seems to be covered in these enigmas that we can't figure out. And when we come right back, we're going to talk about the Nazca lines in Peru. Now, I know that these civilizations were into art, but to create giant pathways and landing strips in the desert to create huge, huge artworks that can only be seen from the air, of which you have no technology to see them from, this is something that almost defies explanation when it comes to a classical, archaeological accepted theory. So sometimes we have to look elsewhere. We're going to see what our guest thinks of it right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with Philip Copens. His website is linked up directly at coasttocoastam.com. And Philip, right before the break, we were talking about the Nazca lines in Peru. And here's something that really defies imagination. I mean, in the sense that it is such a dramatic site with so many features, mountaintops absolutely leveled off. Even the most diehard skeptics has to really be struggling to come up with a way in which that this fits into a believable scenario that doesn't have anything to do with something from the heavens.
Absolutely. And, you know, this was what Eric was saying. This thing needs to be seen from above, because you can't really see anything from you know, a few yards up. Some people, funnily enough, said, like, well, maybe they had ladders. You know, maybe they stood up on ladders and they could see the patterns like that. Yeah, maybe a bit higher than that. Well, you know, again, as I said before the break, Eric posed this question about the Nazca line, saying this thing has to be seen from above. And he, you know, also said it looks like an airport. Now, the operative word there is like, and it's a description. And what happens is that nobody had looked at the Nazca lines, and everybody kind of, like, you know, felt, oh, yeah, we have never looked at this, so we should do some investigation now. Well, 40 years in, what have the people who've been studying the Nazca lines concluded? That there is evidence around the Nazca lines that these people definitely had technology with which they could take to the skies. Now, they say that this technology comes in the form of hot air balloons, that this technology comes in the form of gliders, that some of these people have been, you know, buried with their gliders. But it is a very interesting concept, isn't it, that because they have been so pressed by a single man making furore about a site, that they really have had to conclude that, yes, indeed, these people, you know, could take to the air. Now, is that the total extent of the Nazca lines? At this moment in time, I think there are still, you know, certain things to be there, and there are definitely several things being at equation. Specifically, obviously, the soul flyers are very small replicas of archaeologists are, but really, when you look at them, it's whatsoever, because the wings are actually at the both.
Are you know, having a little bit of trouble hearing you? Yeah, there's something going on with your phone. You're sort of breaking in and out. Have you're not doing anything strange? You're not in the bathtub or anything now, are you?
No.
Okay. Well, let's try a little bit more, and if we have trouble, we'll give you a call back. So take it up again from a few sentences back. You were talking about, you know, the subject on a whole, but as it relates to the specific idea that they must have had technology, they must have been in the air. But beyond that, it seems like there's a larger question of whether it was for them or if it was for somebody else.
Absolutely. And you know, this is where the story of the gold flyers are
You know what? I'm sorry, you're breaking up again. Let's try and call you back. Stay right there, Philip. There's something on the line that doesn't seem to be quite working, and we want to make sure we hear every single word. So right now, Gina is feverishly punching in the numbers and going to dial you right back on the line here. Again, you're listening to Coast AM. Philip's website is really informative. Just go check it out if I haven't mentioned it before. It's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And let's see if we have Philip back on a better connection, because I believe that what happens is that once we start talking about these interesting subjects, it seems like, you know, nothing is for sure. I remember the last show I did, we were talking about ghosts. I was playing some EVP, some electric voice phenomenon, and for the first time in 5 years, the whole phone bank went dead. So we were really freaked out about that. But we're trying to figure him out. I think maybe he has to switch phones. If I were you, Philip, I'd maybe check with you. Maybe I would switch from Verizon to AT&T. I don't know which one you have. They say one is better than the other. I'm not sure. I'm a T-Mobile man myself. But we've got feverishly working on him. You know, unfortunately, this is one of the challenges of doing live radio, that Philip sort of tends to come and go. But we'd rather have him locked in than by chance miss a single word. Now, we're talking about the NASCAR lines in Peru. For people who don't have a mental picture, I can help sort of draw it in your mind. If you saw the last Indiana Jones movie, the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, it was really featured quite prominently in that film. And there are just these huge designs, spiders and monkeys and straight lines that go on for hundreds of yards in this vast flat area of NASCAR Peru. That's a pretty good way of describing it, wouldn't you say, Philip?
Yes, absolutely. It's an excellent way of describing it.
And what I'm curious to know about, and you can go back to what you were saying before, is has there been any discovery or any question of a water system underneath this plateau?
I have had no information about actually something which you know should be investigated. Now, definitely, what I do know is that there is hardly any rainfall on that plateau. That plateau hasn't seen any rainfall, any substantial rainfall, in several hundreds of years, which is why those lines remain so specific. Only a few raindrops each year fall on the Nazca lines.
Mm. Yeah, and you can really carve out just the top layer of the soil, and it'll stay there for thousands of years.
Absolutely, and yep. And that is the amazing thing about the Nazca lines. You know, it's so simple, yet it has remained something. And I think at the there has been an awful lot of has this real and the answer is
well, you know what, you're skipping out again, Philip. I don't know what's happening here. Maybe if you try and I don't know. Is there something in the room maybe that's causing the interference? Do you have you don't have a Tesla coil turned on behind you, do you?
It is probably ancient aliens interfering with whatever is good.
Right, it's the Smithsonian. They're trying to interrupt this service.
Well, this week,
okay. You know what? Let's try and get you back one more time. I'm sorry about this, but it, you're just sort of breaking up. It sounds like you're calling from Mel's hole, for those of you who are diehard Coast to Coast AM listeners like I am. Whatever happened to that? Remember they put the microphone down this supposedly deep hole and they heard these voices from hell? Now, of course, that's a strong metaphor for what we're experiencing now. But that one was always curious. I always wondered about that. It's one of these things that... you know, just leads me to wonder. But again, we're talking about the NASCAR lines. And yes, you're probably familiar with the patterns of the spider and the monkey. But what doesn't get mentioned in the same breath as the NASCAR lines is that right next to it, there is a huge mountaintop that had been completely leveled off with huge engineering undertaking. And on the mountain on the other side, there's this also huge image of a man on the side of a mountain. Philip, let's see if you're back now and if your connection is any better.
I am here.
Great. Well, we'll give it a try. Yeah. So let's pick it up from where we left off. You were talking about these golden, theory of flight.
Yes. Well, so, you know, you're confronted with these Nazca lines, but nearby you have other artifacts. You have gold flyers, which are these little objects, which really, are very interesting, are very mysterious. The scientists say that these are bees or insects, but really, when you look at them, you realize that the body is, the wings are at the bottom of the body. They're not at the top like the case with every insect. And so what is of interest there is that really this is very much the design of a Boeing or an Airbus. And here we are with something which was so interesting that in the 1990s, three German engineers decided to build a scale model of this object from a Bogota Gold Museum. And when they did so, they realized that it flew perfectly. They did test runs on a number of occasions. There's photographs of the flight in my book. And that is one aspect. So you have objects which clearly are small-scale models of flying machines. Then you have, I think it was actually this week, it might have been the week before, that national newspapers everywhere, America, the UK, everywhere, they were reporting about how strange elongated skulls have been found in Peru of beings, which the newspapers were saying, might this be an alien being. Now, I think we don't have to run that far or that fast, but definitely what was happening there was that human skulls, babies, their skulls were molded into elongated shapes because they believed that this was to make the children resemble the gods. And so what you have is again this weird accumulation. In the first hour I was talking about the sacred valley where clearly a civilizing deity walked the path. Well, when we're looking at the Nazca lines, what we're seeing there are people making designs which are to be seen from above, and then we are finding evidence of pretty much people making elongated skulls because that resembles the gods, and then little objects which are not insects but are flying machines. So the emerging picture, I think, is quite straightforward, which is that, definitely Peru visited it.
Mm. Well, what is it about this area, do you think, or these people that were the center of this extraordinary activity?
Well, I think actually this is something which is the work of a great dear friend of mine, Wim Vittman. And he actually identified four places in the world. And I will quickly run them through. One of them is obviously Tiwanaku, which is at the emerging the place where Viracocha emerged. The other one is Teotihuacan, where the gods convened in 3112 BC, which is all linked with this Mayan 2012 calendar. The other is the Great Pyramid. The fourth one is Stonehenge. Now, if you play a little game, and anybody can do this on a map, when you connect Stonehenge to the Great Pyramid and you twist that around on a longitudinal axis, you end up somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. And at that point, you connect Teotihuacan to Tiwanaku and then those two places to the middle of that ocean. Well, the emerging picture you have specifically on a so-called Mercator projection is the constellation of Orion. And everywhere you turn, you will see how important this constellation of Orion is. It's also, the Giza three-star pyramid, three pyramids of the Giza Plateau obviously resemble Orion's belt. The same thing with the Pyramid of the Sun and the Moon and the Temple of Quetzalcoatl in Teotihuacan. And when you start looking into Mayan creation mythology, what they're saying is that our point of creation, where mankind was created, just happened south of Orion's belt. And, when you find out that this information, which is very specific, there are millions of stars out there, but when you find that civilizations across the world have had such extraordinary devotion to Orion's belt for a reason which is inexplicable otherwise, because they're not that brilliant, they're not that intriguing as such. But our ancestors said these were so important. And even in their mythology, because it is a point of creation, it is linked with the return of the gods, it is linked with something. And I actually think the final answer as to why they're so important is far more they came from Orion, so to speak. There is something in there, in that area of Orion, which I think, you know, we still have to explore. I think we haven't found the answer yet.
Well, you mentioned the return of the gods. I have to ask you, you do talk about the Mayan calendar 2012, and it is rapidly coming to an end. It ends just about a year from now, December 21st, 2012. Do you think that on that date it will somehow be a signal, or there will be some sort of return from these non-human intelligences that have been in touch with humanity in the past?
Well, again, the very first question you asked, and my answer was, our ancestors definitely believed so. And this is the case here again. The Mayans definitely believed that 2012 was all about the return of a god called the Bolognuctute, which we would translate as the Nine. And basically, the way the Mayans perceived this is it's as such. They had long count calendars, which started, you know, which lasted 5,000 years, and 2012 is all about the end of a long count calendar. And each period of time was defined by deities coming to them, to their priests, and decreeing with them the fate of the new era. And specifically, in the last 5,000 years, this was said to be spiritual development. It was said that in previous ages, the previous three ages, i.e. the previous 15,000 years, it had more to do with physical development of mankind. But this was the first age in which the gods and mankind, the leaders of mankind, said basically that we should develop ourselves spiritually. And that is definitely, what you see throughout these 5,000 years. You might think that today we're not that spiritually advanced, but I think that we actually are compared to 5,000 years ago. It's only, you know, how far do you really go back? And, you know, specifically, the Mayans believed, there is archaeological evidence for this, that the Mayans believed that on December 21st, 2012, the nine deities would return, make themselves known, and together decree with the leaders of the Mayan community the fate of the world. Now, of course, there's a slight problem there, which is that there is no longer a Mayan civilization. So to some extent, whether something is going to happen or not, it sort of depends on that. But definitely when you start looking into the subdivisions, this 5,000-year cycle was divided in periods of roughly 400 years each. And the last one was in 1615-ish. And at that moment in time, the Mayans had already been conquered by the Spanish conquistadores. And at that moment in time, the Mayan elders declared to the Spanish regime in the Yucatan, in Merida, that they were holding certain rituals on Chichen Itza, and that it was their complete intention that these rituals would make contact with the deities and that deities would appear. Now there is, no further evidence as to whether or not this did indeed happen. But going back into the Mayan timeline, you see that indeed they were absolutely convinced that each 400 years they made contact with these non-human intelligences. And when you start reading certain stuff about the Hopi, you might think that the Hopi are far removed from anything to do with the Maya, but they were part and parcel of the same civilization, the border between.
Well, hold it right there, because we're just about out of time. But we come back, we're going to talk about the similarities between the Hopi and the Maya. We're talking with Philip Copens. His website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And we're also going to ask him about the cosmic imperative that he talks about in his upcoming book and how he thinks it's tied into the extraterrestrial origins of mankind. You're listening to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone, filling in for George Norrie. Don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. Yes, we're talking about ancient aliens. We're talking about the similarities between the Hopi and the Mayans. Could it be possible? We're going to find out. Stay tuned. We're coming right back. Welcome back to Coast AM, the radio show that really is an institution of higher learning, but our tuition is free. We're talking with Philip Copens, and among his books include The Stone Puzzle of Roslyn Chapel, The Secret Vault, Land of the Gods, The New Pyramid Age, Servants of the Grail, and The Ancient Alien question. Philip, right before the break, we were talking about the Mayan calendar and how you pointed out similarities between the Mayan civilization and the Hopi.
Absolutely. And basically, the Hopi...
Hello. Where did you go? Philip, did you disappear me again?
I am
you're
here.
Back. Okay, try it again. Just take two.
I am here. Basically, you know, the Hopi definitely say that they are part and parcel of this Mayan civilization. This border between Mexico and America, the United States, didn't exist at that moment in time. And truly, the Hopi are saying that all of these tribes of the Mayans, the various Native Americans, were really part of this larger civilization. And this civilization had all to do with Orion, with people who, you know, non-human intelligences which were guiding them, who had been guiding them through the ages and who left them, but they are once again expecting them to return. The Hopi are somewhat different from the Mayans. The Mayans were definitely saying, okay, on the December 21st, 2012, the gods are going to return. The Hopi are saying, well, yes, but there is also a series of conditions. And one of these conditions, still needs to happen. And that condition is actually the return of a deity itself, a deity which they call Blue Star.
Blue Star.
And so they are hoping for, you know, his return, which is imminent, they think. And when that happens, you know, they too say that the gods are going to return. So there is...
Yes.
This cyclical return of deities coming to planet Earth. And of course, once again, that is something which is unique to Central America. It's something which you find across the world.
Well, that's interesting. I want to ask you about that because do you see a commonality between the types of themes that we're talking about, the gods of antiquities, the gods coming down from the stars and returning, that is common to Native American peoples across the planet?
Yes. And I think the reason why it is not better known is because they have been subjected to so much horror, so much extermination, that they really feel that, so to speak, if this is the way the Western world treats us, then, you know, why should we divulge information to the Western world? The Mayans definitely have had a change of heart in the last, I would say, 50 years or so. They really feel that they need it, that they need to get this message out there of we are not alone. It's something like which is screaming inside of them. But there are definitely other cultures out there who, make it apparent that we are not alone. The work of Jeremy Narby in the Amazon jungle is extraordinary. He's a very open-minded anthropologist, and he makes it clear that in the Amazonian jungle, this contact with non-human intelligences happens on a daily basis, and we are given technology, specifically in that instance of pharmaceutical information, on a par which sometimes exceeds what Big Pharma and other drug companies are developing. He's taken experts from drug companies into the Amazonian jungle to really see these shamans. And these shamans say, well, you know, the only thing you need to have is ask the gods, and the gods will give.
Here's a question. Do you think that the further away man gets from the natural rhythms of the earth, like the Western world, America, Europe, the more that man surrounds himself with artificial electricity and artificial environments, that he and she are cutting themselves off from this connection to this larger universe, and it's only really the indigenous people who live closer to the earth that have a stronger intuitive connection to this ancient contact?
Absolutely. I'm coming to you from the valley in Los Angeles, very close to San Fernando Mission. It's a place which is, in the last 20 to 30 years become suburbia par extreme and par excellence. But this was a sacred valley. That Mission Peak, is something which is a sacred peak to the native Indians for hundreds of years. And when I look out of my window, well, I can't now because it's dark, but in the morning, you know, what I will see is big masts with radio antennas on it, and very nearby, you know, where the gas company is drilling, or whatever gas companies do to get the gas out of the earth. And this once sacred hill, which, you know, people came on pilgrimages for hundreds of miles to this. Today is just a commonality by the gas company, and you know, the only pilgrims really outside of Native Americans are people who jog it up for like as a test of fitness. Everybody else, you know, like I actually don't know how many people there are in the valley, but several hundreds of thousands have no idea about the importance of the fact that this was once a sacred hill, very much on par with other sacred hills where the gods were said to appear.
Well, what about this idea that you put forward in your upcoming book that life itself is a extraterrestrial in origin and that it's a cosmic imperative?
Yes. Well, when I started doing the book, I felt I had to have an update on this theory of panspermia. And basically, the theory of panspermia is that life has been seeded from elsewhere in the universe, on planet Earth, that it somehow hitched a ride on a meteorite or a comet and came here on Earth. And even the people who discovered how DNA actually looked like, Francis Crick specifically, felt that DNA was simply too complex to have been formed on planet Earth. Basically, DNA is the best photocopying machine you will ever see. It also never runs out, and it makes perfect copies of everything it does. If it doesn't, you see basically, you know, that life cannot happen. Something goes very dramatically wrong. So I thought I was just going to write a very basic chapter, maybe even a boring chapter, about what had happened in the last 20 to 30 years. And the last time I visited this was about 10 years ago when NASA had made this extraordinary discovery. And this is what NASA has discovered 10 years ago, which was that they wanted to recreate interstellar space in a laboratory setting. And when they did so, they found out that DNA and RNA, which is very similar to DNA, the building blocks of life, were formed spontaneously in interstellar space, which basically means that life is a cosmic imperative. Everywhere in this galaxy, in this universe, there is DNA being created out of nothingness, or, you know, however it is being created. And really, the only thing it needs is a meteorite or something passing through this.
You cut out there. Sorry, say again.
Passing through interstellar space.
Okay.
And basically to you know, land on a planet which is able to sustain life. And then you have, you know, a new planet like Earth. And this is something which, you know, they discovered 10 years ago. And it was a dramatic change for NASA. NASA at that moment in time had been doing a search for extraterrestrial intelligences using radio astronomy. And they basically have decided to stop that. And everybody's heard about that, like, you know, how NASA is stopping SETI, it's stopping its budget. Jodie Foster even went on a campaign to get funding. But what people are not realizing as much is that they're not stopping this because they're saying, oh, we're no longer interested. They've changed tack. They're now looking at astrobiology as the new science which is going to identify that we are not alone. And so you not just have only NASA people, you have Russian scientists as well. They made the cover of Popular Science, the October 2011 issue, whereby they're basically saying that in the next 15 to 20 years, both NASA and everybody else in this department is absolutely convinced that they are going to find evidence of alien life. Now, there is something else going on, and it ties back to what we were discussing before. You were the one who said, is there a conspiracy of silence? And in this instance, there is. In season 3 of Ancient Aliens, we had the great pleasure of having Chandra Wickramasinghe as one of the guests. And he has been, you know, instrumental in furthering the cause of that DNA life probably comes from outside of planet Earth.
Okay.
He's even gone as far as to identify that some of the flu viruses and various diseases are probably of an extraterrestrial origin, extraterrestrial literally as out of this planet Earth. And he's gone on record saying that there has been a conspiracy of finance since 1982, whereby evidence that life did not originate on this planet in some sort of primordial soup, but that life instead has extraterrestrial origins, i.e. it literally comes from outside of this planet, has been silenced, that it has anything or anybody who writes about this doesn't get published in scientific publications. They are denied these rights. And if you look at what NASA is doing, they don't get published either. What they do is literally signed by press release. They, you know, they invite people to a press conference. They hold a press conference. They give you a PDF or a printout of the scientific paper. But they know that their findings will not get published in the big scientific publication. And interestingly enough, the people who are, you know, in charge of this conspiracy of silence, they are now accusing NASA of being on a campaign to convince the world mistakenly that there is alien life out there. They basically are saying that, you know, NASA is to blame for people believing that ET is out there. Whereas in truth, it seems to be the reverse. There are people out there who are trying to make sure that the old paradigm that life originated in some primordial soup remains intact, despite 29 years of preliminary evidence and new evidence accumulating every single year that something far more interesting is going on and that life indeed is universal.
Well, whatever your opinion on this, it seems clear that these new discoveries are pushing science where it almost doesn't want to go. It's forcing it into these new areas. Tell me about Professor Davids.
Well, he is a very interesting man. Paul Davids is a very, open-minded scientist. He's connected to the Arizona State University. People might know him because he wrote a very interesting book, How to Build Your Own Time Machine. And people who buy the book shouldn't buy it thinking they can actually build one. But it's more to do with whether or not time machines would actually exist. Now, he has gone, he is actually the editor of a scientific journal of a specific body of science. And he's used that position to write a 4-5-page document whereby he calls for the science of astroforensics. And basically the science of astroforensics is a posh word for ancient alien theories. Now, where this is from ancient alien theories is in the following. He's saying that in the 4.5 billion years of Earth's existence, he's quite convinced that ET once landed here. And he feels that we should start looking for what he calls the alien footprint on this planet. Now, where he and I strongly disagree is on the following. He says that it is statistically less likely, if not completely unlikely, and it is definitely Ian, that this contact did not happen within the human habitation of this planet. I would say that archaeological, anthropological, mythological, and historical evidence from our ancestors clearly shows that, you know, this contact happened within the lifespan of human habitation. So, you know, he's not quite there yet, I would say, but at least he's open-minded and he's pushing science to do these things. One of the experiments he hopes to see accomplished is that, there was the NASA's program called SETI at Home, whereby basically NASA was using home computing as an extra tool to analyze radio signals coming from outer space. He's basically saying we should do the same thing with DNA. So much of DNA still hasn't been researched. 95% is the so-called DNA. Now, science starts is beginning to realize that it isn't junk, but they have no idea what 95% of DNA actually does or stands for. And he's saying that we should start looking into that 95% body of DNA for pretty much signs of tampering. tampering in the sense that it might be that in the evolution of life on this planet, ET indeed has intervened, and that this might be visible within the so-called junk DNA, or that A is possible as well, but also that B is possible, which is that they somehow have left like a tag in our DNA, kind of like saying, you know, we were here, we did this. So it's definitely a very open-minded approach which he is proposing. It's very new. He's only proposed it in August, so there has been very little reaction from the world of academics. But it, at least, you know, it's interesting to see that somebody who is quite of paramount importance within the subject matter is willing to stick his neck out and calling and saying maybe we should start looking for an alien footprint here on this planet.
Well, speaking of aliens, in all of your research in ancient astronauts, ancient aliens, how does the current UFO phenomenon fit in?
I think we need to, you know, kind of like the conclusion of the ancient alien theory book is always like, you know, we were not alone. And then obviously the conclusion of the UFO phenomenon, I think, is we are not alone. Is the UFO phenomenon real? Of course. People see things. You know, is it as straightforward extraterrestrial as so many people, you know, make it into a summary of? I don't think that's the case. I think what we're confronted with is definitely an intelligence. It definitely behaves sometimes very physical, but sometimes it also behaves very non-physical. Some of the abduction stories, for example, Betty Adriansen Luca, as she was investigated by Raymond Fowler, comes to mind, whereby she reports where sometimes it was physical, but also where she sometimes saw her body on the couch laying there, and that the abduction was very much like, you know, like an out-of-body experience. And she wasn't unique in that. You know, John Mack definitely felt that what was happening was far more open and far bigger than just the redux of coming here and doing experimentation on us on a kind of genetic or procreative level. And I think that is once again, you know, where I think that the current UFO phenomenon stands with what was happening before. The central message of contact with non-human intelligence in the past was this: we are not alone, are here to help us if we so want to. They are here to guide us, they are here to transform us, either on an individual basis and or on a more global basis or on a more cultural basis. And it is up to us to really ask them to help us do that, and in that case, they will. That is pretty much what every culture, every civilization has always said about these contacts with these non-human intelligences.
Well, that's a very positive message, and let's pause it right there because we're just at the break. And when we come back, we'll be taking your phone calls for Philip Copens. His website is philipcopens.com. It's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And feel free to call in about anything that we have discussed. Your questions for Philip, I'm sure, are many, so we'll get to as many as possible. We'll try to just shoot everything along. And hopefully, we'll get to all of yours. I know that this provokes a lot of different thoughts and motions, and it stirs up a lot of controversy. And it's okay, because this is where we deal. This is the clearinghouse for all of that. And we're going to get to that right when we come back. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone.